From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the WABE radio studios in Atlanta, Georgia. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
We want border security. We don't want people in our country that don't go through a process. We want people in our country based on merit, not based on a draw, where other countries put their absolute worst in a bin and they start drawing people. Where you think they're going to put their good ones? They don't put their good ones. They put their bad ones.
The suffering of innocent children at the hands of the U.S. government and law enforcement has sparked global outrage. But the work to help save and protect desperate refugees and asylum seekers has been going on behind the scenes for many years. Separate from the politicized rhetoric around so-called sanctuary cities, religious groups have been at the forefront of this work. And today, I'd like to focus on Migdash, the Jewish Sanctuary Movement. We'll hear from Rabbi Salem Pierce, who's leading the organizing and educational effort around Migdash at TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. But first,
the United States of America is a nation built upon the promise of religious liberty. Our founders honored that core promise by embedding the principle of religious neutrality in the First Amendment. The court's decision today fails to safeguard that fundamental principle. It leaves undisturbed a policy first advertised openly and unequivocally as a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, because the policy now masquerades behind a facade of national security concerns. Despite several opportunities to do so, President Trump has never disavowed any of his prior statements about Islam. Instead, he has continued to make remarks that a reasonable observer would view as an unrelenting attack on the Muslim religion and its followers. Taking all the relevant evidence together, a reasonable observer would conclude that the proclamation was driven primarily by anti-Muslim animus rather than by the government's asserted national security justifications. Ultimately, what began as a policy explicitly calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States has since morphed into a proclamation putatively based on national security concerns. But this new window dressing cannot conceal an unassailable fact that the proclamation is contaminated by impermissible discriminatory animus against Islam and its followers. Rather than defend the president's problematic statements, the government has urged this court to set them aside and defer to the president on issues related to immigration and national security. The majority accepts that invitation. The First Amendment stands as a bulwark against official religious prejudice and embodies our nation's deep commitment to religious plurality and tolerance. That constitutional promise is why, for centuries now, people have come to this country from every corner of the world to share in the blessing of religious freedom. Instead of vindicating those principles, today's decision tosses them aside. In holding that the First Amendment gives way to an executive policy that a reasonable observer would view as motivated by animus against Muslims, the majority opinion upends this court's precedent, repeats tragic mistakes of the past, and denies countless individuals the fundamental right of religious liberty.
MSNBC host Rachel Maddow reading from Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor's blistering dissent on this week's narrow majority blessing the Trump Muslim ban. We'll take a look at the moral implications of this ruling, as well as the ongoing baby jails immigration crisis, when I'm joined later in the show by the Reverend Dr. Catherine Henderson, president of Auburn Seminary. But first, let's examine what has actually happened from a legal standpoint. David Cole is the National Legal Director at the American Civil Liberties Union, and I am grateful for getting a few minutes of his time at what is a very busy time indeed. David, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
A lot of analysts were predicting this outcome on the Muslim ban. What do our listeners need to know about it?
Well, I think what they need to know is that this is an order that the president promised when he was running for office. He promised to a complete ban on Muslims entering the country. He said he would do it because Islam hates us. Those were his words. He then explained that because people were upset that he was using the word Muslim, he would target areas of the world or territories rather than explicitly targeting religion. That was on the advice of Rudy Giuliani, who told him that would be a better way to go about it. 1 week after entering office, he put that ban into place, targeting at that time seven countries whose population was between 90 and 99% Muslim. He went on Christian broadcasting television that day to explain that this was designed to favor Christians over Muslims. And notwithstanding all of that, and long-standing Establishment Clause jurisprudence in this country that says that the government must remain neutral as to religions and may not target any particular religion, even for disfavor or for favored treatment, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, upheld the president's actions.
In the recent Masterpiece Cake Shop ruling, the court gave a lot of weight to what's called anti-religion language from the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. But this time, it completely ignored past statements from the president, such as those that you just mentioned. Do you see this as a glaring inconsistency, as Justice Sotomayor clearly does?
Absolutely. In the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, the court reached out to declare that the process that adjudicated the claim between the baker and a gay couple that sought to purchase a wedding cake was infected by religious bias. What was the evidence of religious bias that they pointed to in that case? One commission member, one civil rights commission member, said during a hearing that she said, "I think it's despicable when people invoke religion to harm other people." And another commission member said, "Well, the baker is free to have his religious beliefs, but when he operates a business open to the public, he can't act on them." That was what the court found to be so anti-religious that it justified ruling for the baker without regard to how he treated the gay couple. Those statements are anodyne at best. The statement that you can't invoke religion to harm other people is actually a statement of constitutional law, as is the statement that when you go into business open to the public, you have to serve the public and you can't use your religious beliefs to turn people away. Those were statements of the law, and yet the court found those to be anti-religious animus. Here you got the President of the United States saying Islam hates us, we've got to keep Muslims out, and the court rubber stamps his decision. Absolutely inconsistent.
What else about the Sotomayor dissent is worth noting here?
Well, she makes a very powerful point, particularly at the end, that this is, in essence, a replay of the Supreme Court's decision in 1944 to uphold President Franklin Roosevelt's internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans and Japanese immigrants on the basis of their race. She says, there, as here, the President of the United States acted against a whole group of people based on prejudice. There it was race, here it's religion. There, as here, the president invoked national security for his actions, but offered no evidence whatsoever to support that claim. It was an unsubstantiated assertion of national security. Roosevelt didn't show that any Japanese Americans or Japanese immigrants posed any threat of espionage. President Trump has not shown that any individuals from the countries that are blocked pose a risk of terrorism. And then third, there as here, the court deferred to the prejudice of the powerful, the President of the United States, instead of furthering its duty to protect the rights of the vulnerable. So I think it's a very powerful analogy, and I think Justice Roberts thought it was a pretty powerful analogy, too, because he felt compelled at the end of his decision to say, oh, no, this case has nothing to do with Korematsu. Korematsu was wrong when it was decided. It's been overruled in the court of history and has no place in constitutional law today. But even as he was saying that, he was repeating the very mistake that the court made in Korematsu, and that is blindly deferring to the president without any actual scrutiny of his rationale when the president explicitly acted on the basis of raw prejudice.
Do you see anything in the majority opinion that allows the Supreme Court to go back to this if we see it going awry?
Well, look, it's a blank check to the president, mm-hmm. essentially, because the court says, at least in the context of the borders, the court says, even where the president has blatantly, repeatedly, expressly admitted his anti-religious bias, mm-hmm. ordinarily an absolute non-starter under constitutional law, mm-hmm. even in that context, we will uphold his actions as long as we can conceive of a plausible justification for the action. That's really, taking the court out of the business of checking the president, at least when it comes to decisions at the border. So it is not a narrow decision. That said, Korematsu wasn't a narrow decision.
Right.
But when Korematsu came down, we at the ACLU and many other Americans and Japanese-American groups in particular did not take the decision as the final word and kept fighting to correct the error. Mm-hmm. And in the 1980s, President Ronald Reagan signed a bill, a law passed by Congress that officially apologized to everyone who was interned and paid reparations to the survivors. It was overruled by the people acting through civil society. And I think the same thing will happen with Trump versus Hawaii. I think in the long run, this case will be looked at like we look at Korematsu today, as one of the court's darkest moments, as a moment when the court failed to live up to its constitutional obligation, which is to protect the rights of the vulnerable against the prejudice of the powerful.
A lot of Americans see naked partisanship in everything that happens in our government and culture today, and they're going to see it in this decision too. Are they wrong if they think that?
Well, the decision, the five justices who supported the president were all appointed by Republican presidents, and mm-hmm. the four justices who dissented were all appointed by Democratic presidents. So, it is a 5-4 decision in which the Republicans supported the Republican president. But, I don't know that I would call it partisan so much as I would call it just an institutional failure, a failure on the part of the court to do what its job is. Its job is not to give a blank check to the other branches, but to be a place where people who don't have power can go and have their claims heard, and when their rights are violated, get relief. And here, you couldn't have a more blatant case of rights violations. If any other government official in any other capacity made express statements that he was targeting Jews or Christians or Muslims or Sikhs, and then took action precisely along the lines that he promised, the courts would, in a nanosecond, declare it unconstitutional. It shouldn't be different because the person who engaged in that unconstitutional action here was the President of the United States. He should be subject to the Constitution just like every other government official, and the court's responsibility is to hold him accountable. They failed.
David Cole is the National Legal Director for ACLU. As this terrible initiative was taken up by various courts in its various forms, the ACLU has been at the forefront of both litigation and education on this critical issue. David, thank you so much for taking some precious time of yours today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks for having me.
Up next, the moral aspects of the Trump Muslim ban and the capture of kids with Auburn Seminary President Catherine Henderson. And later, Mikdash, the Jewish Sanctuary Movement. I'll talk with organizer Rabbi Salem Pierce. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. A powerful statement of moral clarity emerged as soon as the disappointing Supreme Court ruling approving the Trump Muslim ban was announced. It reads in part, quote, "Just because the ban on Muslims has been declared legal doesn't mean it's moral or righteous. Attacks on Muslims not only weaken our country in the eyes of others around the globe, but violate the tenets of faith to love the neighbor and exercise welcome and hospitality towards the stranger. Violating these values weakens our relationship with God." Those are the words of the Reverend Dr. Catherine Henderson, president of Auburn Seminary. Catherine, welcome.
Thanks so much, Welton. Great to be back with you and to be in the conversation at such an urgent season in the life of this country.
Muslims, immigrant babies, refugees, LGBTQ persons, it's always about the other with this administration, isn't
right.
it? I'm trying to remember what the Bible actually has to say about the marginalized, about the stranger, when it's not exhorting us to obey the divinely anointed government.
So I think that, you know, we have always faced difficult times. I won't say just like this, but as people of faith, and certainly I'm feeling this acutely as a Christian, because so many things are being done in my name or in the name of Christians right now that has nothing to do with our Christian faith. It has nothing to do with being moral or following in the path of Jesus. I think that Jesus would be horrified, would hate, would be right in the front of the line of resistance right now in what is happening in our country. And I think, you know, the underlying issue here is that this administration, that this regime is about making America white again. This is about underlying white supremacy that is driving many of these actions against Muslims, against immigrants, against black and brown people of all kinds. And, you know, it's a moment where we are called as Christians, as people of faith and people of good conscience to rise up, to stand up, and to resist with all of the peaceful means that we have, which includes, as I did last night, going to Foley Square here in New York City and standing with others to oppose this Supreme Court decision yesterday upholding, you know, the Muslim travel ban. It means that. It means getting out in the streets. It means using our voices in social media, online, from pulpits. And it obviously means voting, helping get out the vote.
Your statement about the Muslim ban ruling encapsulates so well the fact that these kinds of cruel policies really harm everyone, not just the pain and uncertainty and fear for the targeted travelers and their families, but they harm in a very real way those who implement them. Catherine, does that include those in whose name these things are being done, which means us, all of us?
I was heartened hearing that some of the enforcers, the people who are doing this enforcement around separating families, who were realizing that they couldn't do this, that their moral conscience would not allow them to separate families, that people were realizing that their own sense of what was right was being assaulted by being asked to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, that's been true with people who are flight attendants, people who work with airlines, and people are realizing that they don't want to be brought into enforcing what is essentially immoral and what goes against the law of God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at mass incarceration, it's true that the people who are being asked to enforce laws, you know, they are suffering too. And so we have to realize that we are creating a an immoral and cruel circle that will deaden the souls of all of us.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the spiritual and moral harm done to both the victims and the perpetrators of the Trump Muslim ban. Talk, if you will, about how the same principle applies to a policy such as tearing immigrant families apart, as we've all now learned has been happening in our names.
Yes, I think that what we know from other contexts, I mean, if you look at, you know, Germany during the Holocaust, if you look at other authoritarian regimes, you know, there are the people who are most directly impacted.
Mm-hmm.
There are those who carry out and do terrible things in the name of the state or in the name of God.
Mm-hmm.
There are those, you know, who are setting laws in motion, you know, as the Supreme Court did yesterday. And then there are people like Trump, you know, who are heading the whole thing up. And then there are others. There are others of us. They're citizens. They're neighbors. And I think it's incumbent on all of us at this moment to search our own hearts and try to figure out, when do we know what we know, and then when are we going to do something about it?
Yes.
And so it's a moral choice for those of us who come out of the Judeo-Christian faith. It would be a Deuteronomic choice. You know, I set before you life and death. Choose life, so that you and your descendants may live. And I think we're at that kind of moment right now, where we have to decide what kind of individual we're going to be, what kind of communities we're going to be, and what kind of a nation we're going to be.
Mm.
And the way we're putting it at Auburn right now is asking people to consider how we tell the future story of America. How are we going to be telling the story of an America that is more just and generous and equitable than America has ever been?
Mm-hmm.
How do we create the America that has never been but yet could be? And that's the kind of big, major moral decision that we have to make right now. There are two competing narratives at play here. There's the narrative that the Trump regime is now putting into place that is really based on white supremacy, and where there is great fear that's being instilled in the hearts of a lot of citizens of this nation of the other of all mm-hmm. kinds. And then there are those of us who really believe that we can be the inclusive, welcoming, and equitable place that we aspire to be, and that, quite frankly, we think that God intends, because we're all beloved children of God.
When we see the promotion of discrimination in the name of faith, whether it's bakers and wedding cakes or any other bigotry disguised as religious liberty, how damaging is this kind of divisive, defensive rhetoric to the people on both sides of the issue, and how culpable are the leaders who foment these kinds of convictions and actions in God's name?
I was in the room last week in Atlanta with people on all sides of the gun issue, and there were gun owners there and non-gun owners there, and certainly people who had been probably inspired by different sides of heated rhetoric on that particular issue. The interesting thing is that people were so eager to be able to talk across lines of difference and talk across this polarized space with each other. It was an amazingly good conversation. Conversations like this obviously need containers because they need to be places where somebody's holding the space so that difficult perspectives can be aired in a peaceful, constructive way. But I was very interested in how hungry people are to have a conversation. And so, you know, I'm sort of betting on the power of the human soul to do good, even in this moment where there is so much rhetoric that tries to drive us apart. I'm counting on the goodness of people ultimately to be willing to come together across these very polarized differences.
Catherine, I'm somewhat disturbed by some people's temptation to just turn away from all of it. They're tired of it. They want to hide the seemingly nonstop torrent of bad news. What do you say to somebody like that?
It's a very human desire and need. And I think that it is a time where people have to measure how much social media, how much TV news, how much people can actually absorb and process. And that's different, and people need to really watch it because it's very easy to get overwhelmed. At the same time, I think that people need to be seeking community. It's a time when people are feeling that there's not enough that they can do to make a difference, and that people are feeling truly overwhelmed. Even those of us in the work who kind of know how to do this sort of thing, you know, people get very overwhelmed. They snap. And so community, I think, is one of the ways out of this. I was in Washington last Saturday with people on the Washington Mall who were there for the Poor People's Campaign, the Reverend Dr. William Barber and the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris leading, but lots of people singing together, listening together, learning together, and then marching together. And I took some people with us who don't usually do that, people who hadn't marched maybe since the 60s. And we were tired, but we were energized. And the community, it was the community spirit. It was the sense that we're in this together, that we're creating something together. And that is very, very healing. I also think that this is a moment for preachers and poets and art, because that can be very healing. And I wanted to share, Welton, with you and your listeners a little bit of a poem by John O'Donohue, who was the Irish poet who died much too young, 10 years ago, at the age of 50. And his poetry has punctuated my life. But this is just a few lines from something called A Blessing for Our World. Your outlook actually and concretely affects what goes on. When you give in to helplessness, you collude with despair and add to it. When you take back your power and choose to see the possibilities for healing and transformation, your creativity awakens and flows to become an active force of renewal and encouragement in the world. In this way, even in your hidden life, you can become a powerful agent of transformation in a broken, darkened world. There is a huge force field that opens when intention focuses and directs itself towards transformation.
Mm.
So I think that, you know, whether we're praying or meditating on our own or living in our families and smaller communities, or whether we're working in the streets, in the pulpits, in this public way to bring a witness to the possibility, you know, of God's creation, there is the possibility of opening this huge force field for good, and that's what we all need to be about. So this is not a time for stepping back or languishing. This is a time for standing up and stepping forward. And I think that's what we're seeing with so many people across the country. People are standing up and stepping forward, and we've got to do it together.
You're doing the priorities.
Yes.
And that is so good. And I know that preparing leaders for an uncertain future is more important today than ever before, and I'm glad you've got the vision and the energy to do that.
Yeah. You know, Auburn is an institution that works at the intersection of institution and movements. And so our institutional life is enlivened and informed by the movements for justice that we see emerging all around us. And, you know, we are working to support the leadership of people all over this country, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, Buddhists, and people of moral conscience who may not ascribe to a particular faith tradition, but it is an enormously energizing moment, and we are happy to be in the mix and trying to do our part for such a time as this.
The Reverend Dr. Catherine Henderson is president of Auburn Seminary in New York City, an innovative leader and compelling public speaker. Catherine is the author of God's Troublemakers, How Women of Faith Are Changing the World. Catherine, thank you for taking time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's an honor to be with you and your listeners, and let's keep moving forward together.
Few of us were unaffected by the sounds and images of little children separated from their often asylum-seeking parents and scattered around this vast nation in our name. Many of us expressed our outrage in whatever ways we could find. But long-term, an important resource for refugee and other undocumented families and individuals is the New Sanctuary Movement, and a cornerstone of that is Mikdash, the Jewish Sanctuary Movement. Joining us while on a trip to Israel is Rabbi Salem Pierce, who leads organizing and education efforts on this issue at TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. Rabbi Salem, thank you for joining us while in Israel. We're very glad to welcome you to State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with you just briefly describing Mikdash and what it is and where it originated.
Sure. Mikdash is, we're calling the Jewish New Sanctuary Movement. And it really came out of, I think, the Jewish community, most basically. We at TRUA, we're a rabbinic human rights organization, we began to hear from communities all over the country who were saying, the immigration crisis, especially since the new administration in November 2016, is horrifying to us as Jews and as people. Certainly, Jewish history, as well as Jewish text and tradition, has a lot to say about how to treat the immigrant, and then our own experience as Jews gives us much direction about how to treat the immigrant. Mm-hmm. So we at TRUA decided we needed to marshal some resources and education and support and staff for helping communities who wanted to get involved in immigration policy and in helping the lives of our immigrant neighbors.
Mm-hmm. How many communities are participating in the Jewish Sanctuary movement?
Right now we have about, I would say, 70, 75 communities across the country. There are probably more. I get a call every week from someone who wants to get involved and has questions about how to start.
How does this intersect with today's manufactured immigration crisis?
Right. I mean, I think that the Jewish community has a long history of being involved in the sanctuary movement, mm-hmm. Which I think is sort of an extension of, you know, let's say slavery abolition in a lot of ways, in terms of protecting people from those who wish to do them harm. So I think right now this sort of heightened, as you say, manufactured crisis has brought even more people to the table, which has been extremely gratifying to see for me as a rabbi and as a Jew, to see my people really, really stand up. And it's been a wide swath of people that have decided to step up. We've had folks, you know, in one room and, you know, sponsoring one event who normally do not sit at the same table. But the Jewish community has been very, very unified on this issue. And so I think not instead of, but in addition to doing the local sanctuary work in their own communities, Jews right now are responding to national calls. Mm-hmm. Right now, I mean, from Israel, I am working on organizing a delegation of rabbis and cantors to San Diego following the call of the immigrant-led organization Mi Gente.
Mm-hmm. It would help us, I think, if you would describe maybe one or two specific cases that you know about so people get a sense of what you're doing.
Sure. Right now, I'll just use the example of the city of Boston, just because there are several cases there and several Jewish communities involved. But right now, there are several people who have sought sanctuary in various churches across the area. And there are a number of Jewish communities who have signed on to support each of those churches. So the churches are sort of identifying themselves as level one communities, and they are actually housing immigrants who are under threat of deportation. And then the Jewish community is coming together to serve, to help, as what we're calling level two congregations, and they support the church and the people that are in sanctuary, either by doing grocery shopping, providing mental health care, providing child care, legal assistance, staffing actually shifts at the church, because when you have a visitor, when you have someone living in a church, you need someone about volunteers there around the clock. Mm-hmm. So that is, those are some examples. And I would say there's probably, a dozen, maybe two dozen Jewish communities in the Boston area that are involved in supporting immigrants that are in sanctuary in three different churches in the Boston area.
How many people are usually housed in a sanctuary?
Of the examples that I know about, it's usually a person or a person and kids, you know, one person or a couple of people, but usually just one family. Although there are a couple of examples that I know of where a church is hosting multiple mm-hmm. families at once.
Are you getting any kickback from law enforcement or any harassment from people around? How is that going?
Right. So far, it's going fine. I will say that the reason sanctuary works, the reason immigrants who are under threat of deportation are able to seek sanctuary in places of worship, is because of a policy of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, of ICE. Mm-hmm. It is not law, but since for a while now, ICE has had a policy of not interfering in what they call sensitive areas, which include places of worship, universities, hospitals, courts. However, we are seeing that some of that change as ICE begins to pick up people outside of courthouses. And there has been an example of ICE taking someone out of a hospital. So right now it works, and ICE has been adhering to its policy and respecting the sanctity of places of worship. And the response from the community and on the whole has been very good. I think there's a real understanding, nationwide, but in a lot of places, that our immigration system is broken. And we, at times like this, when immoral actions are being carried out by our governments, our duty to resist.
Do you have sanctuaries in the along the southern border of the United States?
I imagine there are. I don't know if there are Jewish communities that are supporting those. Uh-huh.
As aggressive as federal agencies have become on this issue, what are the risks faced by people doing the work of MCDASH?
Right. We always encourage any communities who are going to be involved in what we're calling sanctuary work, which, by the way, we're using as a broad term to describe any sort of immigrant deportation defense. So it could look like a lot of different things. But we do recommend that any community that's going to be engaged in this work consult with a lawyer about what they're doing. Every single place that I know of that has done that has, the lawyers have come back and concluded there's not really a risk to participating in this kind of work, and most places put in place policies in case law enforcement or immigration enforcement comes to a sanctuary with a warrant. Mm-hmm. And it's important to have those policies in place because we do want to make sure that if there is a valid warrant served, that we're not contravening that particular item.
Do you look for volunteers to work with you? I'm asking that because of our listeners. I'm wondering whether they could get involved or support what you're doing, and if so, tell them how to do that.
Absolutely. When people call me, particularly Jewish communities, and say, we want to get involved, the number one thing that I tell them to do is find your local immigrant-led organization, because chances are they are already doing work like this, mm-hmm. and start to build a relationship with them and ask them what they need, and then follow their lead. Usually these organizations have been doing the work for a while and know what they need from faith communities in particular. And I will say that the moral power that a faith community can bring can be enormous. There's almost nothing like a faith community standing up and saying, this is not right, and we are going to support our friends and neighbors that are under threat of deportation.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned what you were doing in Israel at this point, and I really like to hear some more about that. It's a compelling reason to be in Israel right now, and say a little bit more about what you're doing.
Well, right now I am here to take a group of rabbis and cantors on two different trips into the West Bank. Every year there is a learning institute run in the summer for rabbis and cantors. And we time these trips around that because we know there'll be a lot of folks here in the country. We believe that what is most powerful are immersive experiences, which is part of the reason we're taking folks to San Diego next week, but also why we're taking people to the West Bank. You really don't can't understand what's going on in the West Bank until you go and see it. And that's what our program is called, Go and See. Hmm. We, of course, have a certain analysis about what the occupation is and what the Israeli government is doing in the West Bank. But also, we, you know, most American Jews, when they come to Israel, they don't go to the West Bank, and they really don't understand what's going on until they see it up close.
Salem, tell me why you're in this particular ministry.
I think there's a couple of reasons. One, I think Jewish history almost dictates that we as Jews stand with people who are targeted for dispossession. We know what it feels like to live in a place and consider it our home and think that we are safe and we are part of the society, and then to be targeted. We also know what it means to be denied entry to a country when we were seeking asylum. This happened just as recently as, 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. In 1924, when the borders of the U.S. were closed, and mm-hmm. many of us would have much more family today if the borders hadn't been closed. And then in addition, this is personal for me. My sister is married to a man from El Salvador who came to the United States with his mother when he was a child. They were fleeing violence in that country. And so when I think about, I know people who are facing this situation that many who are coming here today are, and I know what it means to have our borders open and for our country to be a place of refuge. And, you know, right now, some of the people who are coming are just like now people who are members of my family. Mm-hmm. And I can't stand idly by while we could, in fact, take in people and offer a place of refuge.
Rabbi Salem Pierce is leading organization and education efforts around Mikdash, the Jewish Sanctuary Movement at Trua, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. You can find many resources on their website, trua.org, and we'll link to that from thestateofbelief.com. Rabbi Salem, I am so impressed by what you're doing and grateful that you're doing it. Thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.